KVDI Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, good morning or afternoon. I think it would probably be afternoon only on the East Coast everyone and here to listen in to Dare to Think Out Loud. I'm Mike Gaddy, standing in for our friend LB, and who is taking a sabbatical for some time. And today I have with me my trusty sidekick, Dave Scorpio, and we will attempt to delve into a very touchy subject today, and that is on, do you really have any rights at all? Well, before we get into that, Dave, you want to say hello to the folks?
Yes, Mike, hello to you and hello to everyone listening. This is going to be a very interesting topic because we're seeing sort of the erosion of that possibility happening in real time right now, Mike.
Well, Dave, nothing could be, more correct. And as we look today, one of the things that started bothering me some time ago, and I've started asking people when they post this anymore, and of course I've made myself some more enemies, but people say, well, that's my constitutional right. I have a constitutional right to do this. I have a constitutional right to do that. And you are infringing on my constitutional rights. Ladies and gentlemen, I am here to tell you, in very stark terms, you have no damn rights. Any right that is subject to the approval of someone else, especially a government, is no right at all. And you may think you have some rights somewhere, but the system was designed from the outset to deny you those rights. Stop and think about it. In 1787, when those people met in Philadelphia, in May of 1787, to come up, they were there allegedly to amend the Articles of Confederation, which they knew before they ever got there they were not going to do. So they met there and they were adamant. They voted unanimously that in their new constitution there would be no Bill of Rights. It was established from the get-go. The only reason that those Federalists agreed to a Bill of Rights was they found out that the people were so adamant about a Bill of Rights that they would not get their Constitution with all of the loopholes mentioned. They would not get that through, or all the loopholes not mentioned, I'm sorry. They would not get that through if they didn't agree to a Bill of Rights. And of course, then the federally controlled Congress destroyed the rights that were sent in by the states and neutered them down to nothing, as was well illustrated in a letter from William Grayson to Patrick Henry after the Bill of Rights had been sent to the states. And he very well delineated how that the rights were nothing and might even be more harm than there were good. And then, of course, we delegated all of this authority, all of this wonderful whatever, to the judicial system of America and how wonderful that has turned out to be. And I will read from one of my articles, and this, I believe, is absolutely true. The voice of the people today in this country is not to be found in the ballot box on Election Day, but will be found in the latest declaration, pronouncement, or ruling by the civil body to which there is no earthly appeal. the Supreme Court of the United States. So all of the rights that you think you have are subject to the arbitrary capriciousness of 9 black-robed bandits. And I think I can go through history and show you how they have perverted what may have been any rights or freedom. And we can go back 115 years ago to start with. And that's Jacobson v. Massachusetts, which happens to deal with the government being able to force you to take a vaccination. 115 years ago, folks. And Jacobson said, no, you can't force me to do that. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said in Jacobson v. United States is that, yes, you have some rights, but they are all subject to the police power of the state. 115 years ago, the Supreme Court told the people of this country, you have no damn rights. Get over it.
Well, Mike, can I ask you a quick question?
Please do.
What vaccine was at hand during this court case?
I'm guessing here, but and I remember reading, but I don't want to say I'm precise, but I think it was smallpox.
Oh, okay.
But that was the case 115 years ago. And look at the Emergency Powers Acts of all of you people who are running around saying, I have rights. I don't have to take this. I don't have to do this. I don't have to do that. You're living a pipe dream. Get some more drugs. Dope yourself up if you're going to try to believe that crap, because you have no rights. Your rights are subject to the whims of those people you decided who are more important in your life than anything else, so you voted for them. And I know that's going to be tough for a lot of people to accept, and especially now as we're seeing the wonderful conservatives out there siding with this ridiculous idea of bringing on martial law so that the wonderful conservatives can get even with those damn liberals who have been trashing their president for the past 4 years. They're willing to throw everything away just to get even. And that's where we are, unfortunately. That's where we are. So what are your thoughts there, Brother Dave?
Well, you know, Mike, it's so funny, this idea. Oh, we're going to declare martial law so Trump can, you know, and deliver the sealed indictments and arrest all the perpetrators. And the thing is, I don't think people understand, like, first of all, we don't even know who is in control of the military. I don't think Trump is in control of the military. And once you declare martial law, things can go sideways very quickly. In fact, they could use such an enactment to force people to take vaccines because it's a national security risk if you don't have your vaccine, among other things.
Well, imagine this. How many conservatives, if they were told when they showed up, if they had a new election and it was controlled by the military, and folks, this has happened in American history. We'll get into that. What would happen if all of these wonderful conservatives showed up at the polls to vote and were told they couldn't vote until they took a vaccine? Every damn one of them would take it, I promise you.
Well, and Mike, they're already throwing around the several terms. One is biological terrorist. Those are people that will be unvaccinated. They're biological terrorists because you're just walking around. You're just a big bag of virus-infested flesh, essentially, without the vaccine.
Well, here's the point, Dave, and I've made this for years. If your damn vaccine works, why do you worry if I don't take it?
That's too much logic there, Mike.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to throw that in there like that. But that's the whole point. And that's the other thing. If your mask works, why do you worry if I don't have one? We cannot get the people in this country out of the concrete stage of human mental development. They cannot stop thinking like junior high people. They can do inductive reasoning. They cannot do deductive reasoning. And if you throw deductive reasoning at them, they get mad. And I'll give you a prime example. I mentioned this martial arts thing on Facebook. Had a person come back and say, well, I think that we should declare martial law, or it should be acceptable because the Chinese have messed with the election in 2020. The Chinese messed with the election and it's all perverted. And so because the Chinese messed with it, we should have the ability to declare martial law. And I said, well, if I follow your line of reasoning, then in 2009, Obama should have declared martial law when everybody was screaming the Russians interfered in the election.
Well, and Mike, you know, it's actually worse than this idea that the Chinese messed with our election. It was well known that the Chinese had deep connections to this company that was counting the votes. Everybody knew it, that was on the inside, certainly. And Mike, what it seems like to me is that the baton of power is intentionally being handed over to the Chinese by, you know, the secret government or whatever you want to call it.
Well, Dave, you and I have talked about that for some time on several different shows. And if we go back to Maurice Strong and look at Maurice Strong, who was possibly, quite possibly, the bastard offspring of Mao Zedong. And he ended up being one of the richest people in the world and was very rich in Canada, was involved in oil and everything else. And then he shows up with Baron de Rothschild in Colorado in 1987 at the Estes Park meeting. And they create the World Conservancy Bank. And then in 2006, here we have a man, Maurice Strong, who moves to China and has $44 million. And suddenly in 2006, he gives $37.5 billion to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And now we know what Bill and Melinda Gates have been involved in. Vaccines. And I don't believe in coincidences.
No.
So it's absolutely incredible, Dave. But I just can't understand why. What do you have to do with people to convince them that you have no rights? You are a slave on that great federal plantation. You can go where the master says you can go. You can buy what the master says you can buy. You can achieve if the master says you can achieve. You are poor if the master says you are poor. You might be able.
Mike, you know, this is exactly what's playing out in real time right now. For example, you know, I don't know if you caught this, but Mayor Gil Garcetti is saying it's time to shut everything down in Los Angeles. And there's even regulations now against walking,
any kind of travel.
Everything needs to close, all under the guise of this virus that's, you know, ubiquitous, allegedly, supposedly.
Well, and all of the people, Dave, who think their rights are being violated with this are on an acid trip. Because look at the police powers, the emergency powers that are granted to every state governor, and then down the line to the mayors and what have you. None of this, you have no rights. You are told what to do and when to do it, and by damn, you better jump on the wagon.
Well, Mike, let me ask you, these emergency powers that were granted to governors, was this done when the state constitutions were formed, or is this some kind of action that was taken later?
Well, most of the rest of it came in later, but that you bring up a great point because, and we've been discussing this on a couple of other shows, and that goes back to Reconstruction. For the southern states, 10 southern states were kicked out of the Union. Now, don't forget, we fought a war to keep the Union together, according to Abraham Lincoln, King Abe the First. We fought a war to keep the Union together. So then, when the war is over and the North has prevailed, and the North sends out the Republican-dominated Northern Congress, sends out the 14th Amendment for ratification, and the southern states say, not no, but hell no. So what does the Republican-dominated Congress do in 1867? Well, they say, well, if you're not going to ratify the 14th Amendment, we're kicking you out of the Union. And not only are we kicking you out of the Union, but we are putting you under a military dictatorship, which is what the Republicans are yelling for again. We're going to put you under a military dictatorship, and you will, all of your courts will be administered by the military. All of your elections will be administered by the military. You can't do anything without permission from the military. So we have a precedent for this.
Yeah. And Mike, you know, what I'm seeing too is, you're just seeing more and more use of the military in civilian affairs. It's happening all the time now. You know, there's guys, National Guard guys, handing out food at the food lines. You know, Operation Warp Speed. We need the military to, you know, disseminate this vaccine. And I'm just noticing too, like President Trump was talking. I just saw a news clip from yesterday. He was talking in the Oval Office, and there was like four police-looking guys and two military guys just standing there behind him. Like, what are they doing there?
Well, they are exhibiting authority, and that's what it's going to be on the streets. That's going to what's going to be everywhere, and we are reliving. And folks, I want to tell you, Donald Trump is living up to one of his campaign promises. He is actually doing and honoring one of his campaign promises. In a Detroit church in 2016, Donald Trump said, "I am proud to be a member of the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln. And I hope to bring the Republican Party back in line with the administration and the doctrine of Abraham Lincoln." He's doing it. Hope you like it. But that was complete. Lincoln did complete military control. Most people are unaware of their own history. But stop and think about it. One of the first things Lincoln did when he was afraid that, of all things, because of their strategic location geographically, Lincoln sent the military under the leadership of General Butler, Benjamin Butler, who later became known as Spoon's Butler because he stole all of the silverware in New Orleans after he was sent there. But one of the things, they sent Butler into Maryland. And what did Lincoln have the military do there? He was afraid they were going to vote to secede, so he had the entire legislature and the mayor of Baltimore arrested and taken into military custody, and then he put the military on as legislature, and they voted not to secede. Imagine that.
Wow, and of course, if you've ever visited the Lincoln Monument in Washington, D.C., Lincoln's hands rest on a fasci, of course.
Oh, really? I used to go down there at nighttime and say bad things to Abraham Lincoln when I lived right across the river in Arlington.
Just a coincidence, though.
Yeah, just a coincidence. But, you know, we talk about the courts, and I used to tell people the Federalist promised, but the Anti-Federalist predicted. Now, I want to use an example here, and I want to tell you, let's go back to the founders that everybody thinks were divinely inspired. Depends on who your God is, I guess. But let's listen to the words of Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78, when he said, "The simple view of the matter suggests several important consequences. It proves incontestably that the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power, that it can never attack with success either of the other two, and that all possible care is requisite to enable it to defend itself against their attacks. It equally proves that though individual oppression may now and then proceed from the courts of justice," wow, how nice of you to admit that, "the general liberty of the people can never be endangered from that quarter." Let me say that again. The general liberty of the people can never be endangered from that quarter. Now let me repeat Jacobson v. the United States 115 years ago. 1905, when the Supreme Court said, "Your liberties are subject to the police power of the state." And they admitted right then that they agreed with what was to come later, would be called Mao Zedong, who would say that the political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. Where does the power of the police come from? Out of the barrel of the gun. Same as with the military. But look at that, and then let's jump to an anti-federalist who happened to later become the Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court. And he wrote in opposition to the ratification of the Constitution, and he wrote under the name Brutus. And this is what he said. I said in my last number that the Supreme Court under this Constitution would be exalted above all other power in the government and subject to no control. The business of this paper will be to illustrate this and to show the danger that will result from it. I question whether the world ever saw in any period of it a court of justice invested with such immense powers and yet placed in a situation so little responsible. Now, who was right, Alexander Hamilton or Robert Yates?
Yeah. And, you know, and you brought up the case about the vaccines from 100 years ago. And of course, that's the foundation. You have so-called case law that they can build upon and say, ah, see, we can do that. It was decided 100 years ago. It doesn't matter if that case was constitutional or not, so-called constitutional. The fact is it's case law now. And so we can build upon that and even derive more power from it.
Well, Dave, we got into a discussion last night on the show with Terry and Daryl Wayne, and we were discussing the Supreme Court and their precedent. The Supreme Court, at its own discretion, has chosen to ignore precedent when it doesn't fit its political agenda. So they only throw this precedent thing at you when they can use it against you. If precedent plays in your favor, as it did with the non-ratification of the 14th Amendment, and the Supreme Court had a chance to overthrow that when it was proved not to be properly ratified. And what did the Supreme Court say? Well, we'd have to overturn, and this happened in 1950s. And the Supreme Court said, we'd have to overturn 100 years of decisions if we did that, and we don't want to do that. So, no, we're not going with precedent. When previously, in 1836, the Supreme Court had agreed that even if they had to go back and overturn laws because of something being found unconstitutional, if they had to overturn precedent, they felt like justice demanded that they do it. That was the difference between 1836 and 1950.
Okay, wow, interesting.
So, again, I don't know how to get people to understand, it's like having a very bad taste in your mouth every time on Facebook and other places, or even on YouTube and what have you, when I hear people say to talk about their constitutional rights. You have no constitutional rights. The Supreme Court said you don't. Or if you consider the fact that you have rights, they are subject to the approval of other people. Let's go back to a more recent case of the Supreme Court in Heller versus D.C., where the Supreme Court said that the right to keep and bear arms was an individual right. And everybody turned double backflips and did all kind of, yay, 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 look, the Supreme Court said that. They didn't read the rest of the decision. Antonin Scalia says the liberties of the people are always subject to the reasonable restrictions of government.
Now, wow, that's big enough to drive a truck through, Mike.
Yeah, who gets to decide what's reasonable? It's not us. If you don't get to decide what's reasonable in your rights that are granted by your creator, if you put somebody in power to decide for you what's reasonable, you are not free. People have to get out of this understanding. You are wearing mental shackles. Just like the slaves wore physical shackles, you are wearing mental shackles when you chain yourself to this. As you know, my program on Sunday night is Addicted to Your Own Destruction. And that's exactly what this country is. They have walked around for decades, centuries, believing that they had rights. The Constitution of 1787 was the repudiation of the Declaration of Independence. Now, that is, I can prove that in so many facets in so many ways. But, you know, nobody wants to believe that. So let's turn on TV and watch a football game.
Interesting. That's why you don't hear much about the Declaration of Independence or the Articles of Confederation. It's all about the Constitution. And we're seeing, you know, what you're saying is so true, Mike. We're seeing all these so-called rights just unraveling like a cheap sweater right now under this so-called COVID crisis. You know, and the police are being used more and more simply to enforce the COVID rules, the COVID masking rules and other rules, while other crime is allowed to run rampant. I have a friend that lives in New York City, and he's saying that the crime is just out of control there. But the cops and the government are clamping down on businesses and people, making sure everybody follows the COVID rules.
Well, the government always puts its most resources on its most feared enemy. And they're not afraid of crooks. They're afraid of honest people. They're afraid of the people who might demand and who might stand up and say, not no, but hell no. You're not doing this anymore. See, this is one of the things people say, how could we, somebody asked me, how could we really stand up against this government? I said, well, if everybody in this country would refuse to wear a mask from this point forward, what's the government going to do? The people have the power. They just won't use it. They're like the elephant. The elephant was trained with a little rope that it couldn't go outside of certain boundaries. And it would walk so far. And then as the elephant gets big enough to pull down a building, they still harness it with that same little rope, because in the mind of the elephant, I can only go to the end of my rope.
Well, that's a great analogy, Mike.
And Americans have been chained with the same thing. They have been trained and thought that, oh, I've got this Constitution. I've got this Bill of Rights. I have these rights. The government can't do this. Tell that to Lavoie Fennecum. Tell that to Vicky and Samuel Weaver. Tell that to the children that were burned in Waco. See you on the flip side.
Engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me death!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point on Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Magic.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution Radio!
Alright, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, welcome back, folks, to Dare to Think Out Loud. Normally you would hear L.B. Bork at this time, but you have me today, so you're going to have to put up with it. So suck it up and go. My name's Mike Gatti. My co-host is... my good friend Dave Scorpio. And first of all, I'd like to tell you folks that Revolution Radio is a, you know, listener-supported paradigm. We're out there. It's an entity that's supported by the people. If you like free speech, if you like that First Amendment thing that says you have free speech, then this is the avenue to express it. So if you want to promote free speech, promote Revolution Radio and go to the website, donate, buy some products, do whatever you can to help with the spread of free speech. And if you don't like what I'm saying, that's fine. But I have a right to say it with free speech. And there are folks on other parts of Rev Radio that would say stuff that you like. So let's keep them free to say what they want just as much as for those you might not like at all. So, Dave, what's your thoughts, buddy?
Well, I would just add that, you know, go on revolution.radio and freedomslips.com and become a Patreon member. And like you said, buy some shirts, or there's a whole bunch of other cool stuff on there. Just do whatever you can to help keep this bastion of free speech going. Because as we're learning very quickly, Mike, they are taking away people's right to free speech. You know, Giuseppe and myself were recently we're in YouTube jail for spreading medical misinformation because we question the masking and the vaccine agenda. So there you go.
Well, that has always troubled me. And when you sent me an email and told me that, or sent me a message on Skype and told me that, I was just absolutely incensed. Because here is the point, Dave. If you are selling the truth, you welcome critics. You welcome people who have an opposing viewpoint because you can debunk their lies. You can debunk their mistruths. You can debunk their misinformation. If you do it publicly, people have even more faith in you. But if you start shutting people up who oppose you, you are saying, I am lying to you and I don't want anybody to know it.
Right.
That troubled me from... That has troubled me so many times. And you know, for you, all of you good conservative Republicans out there, you didn't say a damn thing when George W. Bush had free speech zones when he made public appearances. You could not demonstrate against the good Republican and where he was giving a speech. But they did have a lot for you, like three blocks away, fenced in lot where you could go in and protest all you wanted to, but nobody could hear you.
Yeah, like a little cage, too.
Yeah. That I saw that in person in Farmington, New Mexico. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Bush is in town. He's going to speak, but no dissension whatsoever. There can be no protest. We cannot brook dissent because they will expose us for the damn frauds we are. So don't even begin to think you're going to have a right to challenge what I'm telling you. And that's exactly what they're telling you, folks, and you just keep taking it. But
well,
one of the things,
it's interesting, Mike, too, with the you know, Twitter and all the social media platforms, YouTube, Facebook, they started off saying, well, you're violating our community standards. And of course, that's sort of like a necessary and proper clause. You can just drive a truck through it. And what they're doing is they're expanding this until essentially anything that contradicts the government narrative will be forbidden and censored.
Well, You know, Dave, that's going to take me back a little bit, and that brought this to mind. I can remember 20, 25 years ago or so, every time a Democrat was in office as president, everyone I knew would say, well, the press is left-leaning. It's a liberal press. Well, when the Republicans got in and the press supported them like they did George Bush's lies to go to war in Iraq, when they supported all of their lies, it wasn't a liberal press anymore. And I remember writing articles 25, 30 years ago that, hey, folks, this press is government supportive. It doesn't support the right or left. It just depends on who's in power. And it's... Go ahead, Dave.
No, I would just add one quick thing that is essentially the press supports the globalist agenda, and the globalist agenda has some so-called right-wing parts to it, like war, and left-wing parts to it. So it's all they're doing is supporting this covert agenda that they don't want people to know about, so they encapsulate it in the left-right paradigm.
Well, think about what we're seeing now in massive doses of, controlled opposition. And here's the thing that you do. If I want to get you to believe an idiot like Alex Jones, if I want you to get to believe an idiot like Rush Limbaugh, if I want you to believe any of these people, Sean Hannity, if I want you to believe these people, what I do is I have them tell you 7 truths in a row. And automatically you have checked them out and you believe them. After you have taken them into your confidence, they can lie to you till hell freezes over and you won't believe it. You will not believe they're lying. You will trust everything they tell you, and that comes directly from Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister in Nazi Germany. Read up on it. We will have these outlets to tell you the truths that you want to hear, and you will accept it. And then that becomes a reliable source. Once it becomes a reliable source, then we will use them for propaganda.
Right. And, Tucker Carlson does the same thing, Mike, as you already know. And, recently, Tucker Carlson came out and said that people that question the 9/11 narrative are parasites.
Yeah, well, they have to do that from time to time. They have to keep throwing that stuff out there. It's absolutely amazing, continues to be amazing to me. But one of the things I wanted to get to, and I mentioned it earlier when we were talking, Dave, in the first segment, and I talked about a letter from William Grayson to Patrick Henry after the first Congress of the United States had settled on the Bill of Rights. And there has to be some background here. You won't understand it. 99.8% of the people have never heard of William Grayson. Maybe in today's world, 70% have heard of Patrick Henry. But the only thing they know is Patrick Henry said, give me more government or give me death. And no, that wasn't it, was it? Give me liberty or give me death. There you go. Well, if you have anyone teach you about Patrick Henry today, they will convert that into Patrick Henry was a statist. I promise you, it is the perversion of lies, the perversion of truth into lies. But anyway, William Grayson was one of the senators in the first U.S. Congress. And the two senators from Virginia were the only anti-federalist senators in the entire Congress, and they got there because of Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry worked within the legislature to try to get as many anti-federalists as he could into the first Congress because he knew the people who created the Constitution were going to try to put all of their people in power so they could manipulate that Constitution to do exactly what they had intended to do to start with, and that was create a monarchy. So he got William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee in as senators. So in the first U.S. Congress, the Federalists in the Senate, the Federalists outnumbered the Anti-Federalists 20-2. In the House of Representatives, the Federalists outnumbered the Anti-Federalists 39 to 11. Supermajority in both places. But when the Bill of Rights had all of the rights that the states had suggested and had sent to the first Congress, which were just literally destroyed by that Federalist-controlled Congress, here is what William Grayson wrote to Patrick Henry on September the 29th of 1789. The process is all done on the Bill of Rights. They've been sent to the states, and I will explain parts of this letter. It's not that long. But here it goes, and I quote, "With respect to amendment matters, with respect to amendments, matters have turned out exactly as I apprehended from the extraordinary doctrine of playing the after game." And that was, the Federalists said, okay, give us, ratify our Constitution, and we'll put some Bill of Rights in it after you have ratified it. But ratify it first. Nancy Pelosi, let's vote for it, see what's in it. So then they said, okay, now you can send in your amendments and everything will be taken care of. So that's what he meant by the after game. So here, let's move on. He says the lower house, House of Representatives, sent up amendments which held out a safeguard to personal liberty in a great many instances. But this disgusted the Senate. Now remember, 20 to 2 Federalists. Disgusted the Senate, and though we made every exertion to save them, and he was talking about he and Richard Henry Lee, they are so mutilated and gutted that in fact they are good for nothing. And I believe, as many others do, that they will do more harm than benefit. People, you're living it today. The Virginia amendments were all brought into view and regularly rejected. Perhaps they may think differently on the subject the next session, as Rhode Island has refused for the present acceding to the Constitution. Short letter, but I want to read that again. Here is a man who was involved in the process, and he says that we made every exertion to save them, but your Bill of Rights are so mutilated and gutted that in fact they are good for nothing. And I believe, as many others do, that they will do more harm than benefit. This is a eyewitness view, people. This is a man who fought to try to keep those liberties in the Bill of Rights, and the Federalists did everything they could to weaken them and destroy them, and that's why you have no rights today. You believe that you do, but you don't. So any thoughts on that letter, Dave?
Well, it's absolutely stunning, and it certainly adds a lot of force to your conclusions. From an actual eyewitness, this isn't something you made up or decided to postulate on. This is an actual historical document from someone who was actually there. It's shocking, and it really should give everyone listening a reason to pause and reconsider the paradigm that we're living in, especially as we're watching all of our so-called rights being eroded away very, very quickly at warp speed.
Well, I think it goes back to the title of our Sunday program, Addicted to Our Own Destruction. We have been taught by Marxist history teachers for the better part of a century a false accord of history. The question I would ask you is, how many times in your education, Dave, and you have a very good, what we would consider a very good education today, how many times in your history had you ever heard of William Grayson?
Never. Absolutely never. And I actually majored in American. I had a double major, but one of my majors was American history. So that's pretty sad.
Well, and again, and I don't mean to be redundant for people who have heard this before, terribly redundant, but in one of the Handling the Truth radio shows, Terry Dodd and I were speaking with an attorney from New Jersey who had sued Obama in 2009, claiming that he was not a natural born citizen. Now, the circumstances around that, I have to tell you, which are incredible. He made the lawsuit citing that the president was should not be there because he was not a natural born citizen. And he filed it in federal court. And so the federal court immediately said, you have no standing. And so he inquired to the court as to why, as a voter, as an attorney, do I have no standing on who was elected to be my president? And the court said, you have no standing. So this attorney, a 40-year experienced attorney, went out and found himself a retired U.S. Army colonel. And he used him as the plaintiff instead of just being an attorney because he thought that was the answer. So he went to court, and this is especially relevant in what we're facing today. So he takes it to the federal court with a new plaintiff, a retired U.S. Army colonel. The federal courts come back and says, sorry, you have no standing. So his question again is, I have a man who served the country for 28 years or whatever it was in a capacity in the U.S. military. And you are telling me he is a voter. He is a citizen of the country. You're telling me he has no standing in federal court to decide the validity of his president. And the court said, you have no standing. And so the attorney inquired again and said, okay, who would have standing? And the court said, only the other candidate has standing.
That's so amazing. I hear this. You don't have standing used all the time in courts now. Whenever they want to dismiss a case, that's what they say. It's sort of a blanket go-to statement that they can use. And Mike, correct me if I'm wrong. If to be a natural born citizen, both of your parents have to have been citizens when you were born. Is that correct?
That is correct.
This whole birth certificate thing really was a red herring in a way, because it was obviously provable that his father was not an American citizen.
Well, and the point of, and I'll get back to my original point on this one in just a minute, but here was the thing that I said during that radio show, and that was the Republicans in this year, we were talking about Kamala Harris because this gentleman was thinking about filing papers on Kamala Harris if Biden was elected, which they say he has been. And, you know, that's going to be disputed, I'm sure, will be disputed when we're long gone. But anyway, we were talking about Kamala Harris, and she definitely is not a natural born citizen. And so we were talking about the details of that. And inextricably, if we go by Vattel's Law of Nations and their description, which our founders quoted most often or talked about Vattel quite a bit in the Law of Nations, he was mentioned. And so there we have the issue of even would it even now the Republicans had a chance to stand on the high ground, to stand on the moral ground in 2016, if they would have told Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, you are not natural born citizens and therefore you cannot run for president as Republicans. What a statement that would have made for these people who claim to support the Constitution. If the Republican Party would have said, sorry, guys, we love you, but you cannot run as president. You are not constitutionally eligible. But did the Republicans do that? No. So then, now they don't have a leg to stand on. Because, and that's what this attorney said. He said, now if I come up and claim that Kamala Harris is not a natural born citizen, he said, I have no legal standing because the Republicans have said it's all right to do it.
So, Mike, does the natural born citizen thing only apply to the president and the vice president? Because we have Congress critters that weren't even born in the United States now.
Well, and that depends also depending on the state. The state can set its own parameters for those. They can decide the eligibility of their people. So it depends on the state. But as I understood it at the time, Ted Cruz is not even should not even be a senator in Texas.
Yeah, he was born in Canada, wasn't he?
Well, his parents, I believe he was born in Canada, and his father was a Canadian citizen. Was not a U.S. citizen.
Wow.
So, but to get to the point, and this was one of the things, and it's a small point, but with that attorney, we were discussing, and I brought up something to him during that discussion, and I said, well, counselor, you have to remember that Luther Martin said this at the Constitutional Convention. And I gave him a quote, and he said, you mean Martin Luther? Martin Luther was not at the Constitutional Convention. I said, counselor, have you never heard of Luther Martin? And he said, no. Now, here is a man who is an accomplished attorney of 40 years, went through law school, obviously, and he had never heard of Luther Martin, who was the longest seated state attorney general in the history of this country. And he had never heard of Luther Martin, had never discussed Luther Martin in any law school class or anything else. And that was because Luther Martin opposed ratification of the Constitution. So they just leave these people out of history. So you have been deprived of the truth throughout your educational experience. But you believe because some teacher told you something or some professor told you something that it was gospel truth. And when people present you with the truth, you get all upset and say, no, that can't be true. I was told different. I've seen it for 30 years. People do not want to accept the truth if it makes them uncomfortable.
Well, especially if it was something that was drilled into your head when you were a little child. That's the hardest programming to overcome.
Well, Dave, I, you know, I resemble that remark because I remember being taught about, you know, told in Sunday school that the Constitution was inspired by God and all of these other things. I had heard that almost my entire life and through my educational experiences, basically the same thing. They might not have got into the God part, but it was an inspired document. And look at all how wonderful it's been. And then I happened to be in the National Archives in the Library of Congress starting in around 82, 83. And I started going through the documents there. And I found out, you know, I can remember going home and sitting down in my apartment and being so disgusted. And at one point in time, I can remember sitting there and I said, I either have to believe what's in these original documents and be very uncomfortable, or I have to go back to what I was taught and just accept it and be fat, dumb, and happy. Well, unfortunately for me, or fortunately for me, whichever way you look at it, I couldn't accept that. I had to go with the truth. And these documents, like I just read you, are there in the National Archives. They do not lie. And this is firsthand experience. During the adoption of the Bill of Rights, there were 141 letters that passed back and forth between members of Congress and people back in the states and between the members themselves discussing the Bill of Rights. And to read those 140 letters is an education in itself. And if you read those 140 letters, I promise you, you will understand, just like with Mr. Grayson, that you have no rights. There's nothing there. It's an illusion. Because the government has a trapdoor for every one of them, just like that Jacobson versus United States. Your liberties are subject to the police powers of the state. And then if you have enough people in this country who have been indoctrinated into Marxism in the public school system, the majority of the people in this country agree with that. They agree with socialism. You're not going to outvote them. Just the view from my saddle here on a Friday, Dave.
Well, yeah, and I don't see how anybody can deny what you're talking about now, because here we have, you know, governors in multiple states saying that you need to put your mask on in between bites and telling you how many people you're allowed to have over for Thanksgiving. So, and of course, they're saying to cancel Christmas. We can't have Christmas. I believe the battle cry against Christmas is going to only increase as we go on here, because that's the most loathed and hated holiday of them all.
Well, naturally, but you look at these hypocrites. Look at Newsom in California. He went to a huge party. He had made his edict, his demand as a governor under emergency powers, that you couldn't do what he could do. And so he did it anyway. And then what does he do when he's caught? When there's a picture of him at this great gathering, he says, "Oh, I feel so bad. I'm so sorry." Sounds like Jimmy Swaggart after he was caught with a prostitute. "Oh, I am so sorry. I just really hate this." And then you had the mayor of San Jose, who told the people on Thanksgiving, "You will stay. You will not do your inner family stuff. You will stay. This is the edict from the mayor of San Jose." So what did he do for Thanksgiving? He went out to visit with his parents. Other people can't, but they can. People, do you not see this? Can you not understand what's happening to you?
And it just came out the other day that the mayor of the capital of Texas,
Austin.
Yeah. He was caught traveling to Cabo on a private jet with people who weren't even in his family for the Thanksgiving holiday. And the other thing that is interesting about this phenomenon we're talking about, Mike, is that it shows you that these people in positions of power know that this thing is a fraud and a hoax, or else they wouldn't put themselves and their families at risk, would they?
Well, absolutely. They know it, but it's not part of the plan. All right, we'll be back on the flip side for another hour of Dare to Think Out Loud.
I will defend myself against their tyranny. Number 3 is my radio broadcast. I'm squarely in front of the public all the time, and they all know what's going on.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
Hello, my name is John Wayne, and I do a broadcast here at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio, called The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
Freedom and fear are at war.
And folks, I assure you, we are in defense condition 1. As we journey perilously through this paradigm that we currently reside in, and I ask that you join me every Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
We shall never surrender.
We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what?
Come here.
What are you going to do, bleed on me?
I'm invincible. You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs!
Roundtable Live Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to Dare to Think Out Loud. And we've been doing a lot of that in the past hour, and we plan to move forward with even more of it as we complete the second hour of Dare to Think Out Loud. And standing in here for LB Bork is Mike Gatti and my good friend Dave Scorpio. And Dave, I went to an official government website just to show you how much we're lied to. I went to an official government website called the National Endowment for the Humanities and their discussion on the Bill of Rights. And it's called Building the Bill of Rights. So let me read you the first sentence. Now, we've just read a letter from William Grayson to Patrick Henry, which is authenticated truth. Now, let me read you what the government says. It says, and I quote, "Federalist and anti-federalist put aside their differences and agreed on a Bill of Rights." Does it sound like, from what I read from William Grayson, does it sound like they put aside their differences and agreed on something?
Well, absolutely not. And, you know, we're coming to the same kind of conflict now where you're not going to be able to put aside your differences when the differences are so great as between freedom and absolute totalitarian dictatorship by the government.
Well, that is, you know, I was just thinking of something this past weekend. Thanksgiving weekend, I decided I wanted to do something and just to check up on today's education. So I enrolled in a 5-week course. I enrolled in a 5-week course on Patrick Henry, which was presented by a professor from the University of Virginia who has written books and papers on Patrick Henry. And I took all of his lectures, which are video recorded, for the course, all 5 weeks, and I completed that course in a weekend. And, of course, you know, I jammed stuff in. I had a lot of time. And I completed that course in a weekend, listened to every lecture, and took all of his tests. And I missed, of the 5 exams, I missed 2 questions, but those 2 questions, I believe, were what I answered was right, and what they had was the Federalist point of view. But it was amazing to me that this professor could take Patrick Henry and all his diligent fight against the ratification of the Constitution, and to take Patrick Henry and manipulate his words and manipulate what he said and convert him into a Federalist. Which reminded me that in the newspapers of 1787, 1788, when the Constitution ratification was being debated, the Federalists took out fake news stories in the newspapers claiming that Patrick Henry had switched to being a Federalist. So fake news is nothing new.
So wow. Yeah, and just the idea that you're going to, the two sides put aside their differences, that's just, that sounds like something right out of NBC Nightly News from today, Mike.
Yeah, well, you know, and the thing that gets me is that people will be laudatory towards James Madison. Oh, you know, George Washington may have been the father of our country, but James Madison was the father of the Bill of Rights. Well, if you want to find out what James Madison was like during the battle for the Bill of Rights, go read the day-to-day arguments in that Congress. If there was a person who was trying so hard, probably harder than any other member of Congress at that time, it was the congressman from South Carolina by the name of Thomas Tudor Tucker. Now, did you hear about him in your history classes, Dave?
No.
Well, Thomas Tudor Tucker went tooth and nail with James Madison repeatedly over amendments. Now, here was the thing to show you how bastardized that Bill of Rights is that every state, all 11, because North Carolina and Rhode Island did not submit initially because they had voted against ratification. But the 11 states that submitted their Bill of Rights, their proposed Bill of Rights, every state had right at the top of their list or near the top of their list one amendment, and that amendment was that there can never be any direct taxation on the people. Now, the committee in the House of Representatives that was whittling these 100 and some amendments down rejected the no direct taxation on the people. They rejected it in the committee. Well, then when they get to the committee of the whole, back in the whole House of Representatives, Thomas Tudor Tucker brings it up three more times. And who fights the hardest against preventing it being there? James Madison. And then when it comes to the 10th Amendment, Thomas Tudor Tucker wanted the word expressly placed before delegated. And in the argument over the 10th Amendment, James Madison says, and for people who would like to see this, just let me know. I'll be happy to send you the transcripts of the arguments over the Bill of Rights, the actual transcripts from the Library of Congress. And they ask, and so Tudor Tucker brings it up again on the 10th Amendment, expressly delegated. James Madison said, and I'm paraphrasing, you cannot hold the government to strictly defined rules. The government in itself must have rules by implication. James Madison said the government's not going to go by the rules. They will do what they want to do. They have rules by implication. They have implied rules, implied powers that you don't even know about. Imagine that, Dave. Here is the guy that today is lauded by the 10th Amendment Center as the holy grail of the Bill of Rights, and he fought against making the powers of the government specific.
Right. Now, could you expound upon these like implied powers? Like, where does that take us?
Well, that's the necessary and proper clause. That is exactly what that Thomas Tudor Tucker was trying to limit, was that clause. He did not want the government to have powers that they could say was necessary and proper. He did not want them to be able to justify anything they did, which, by the way, Luther Martin had brought up with the legislature of the state of Maryland when he told them that if we take the necessary and proper clause, the general welfare clause, the unlimited taxation clause, and the supremacy clause, if we take those four pieces of legislation in the Constitution, we're doomed. We have no authority whatsoever as a state, and the federal government will do any damn thing they want to. And he had said that. Here was Thomas Tudor Tucker in the amendments trying to limit those powers. And James Madison says the government cannot be limited to the powers that are specifically enumerated. So they were saying in the beginning, we're not going to stay within the limits here. We're going to do whatever the hell we want to. And the people who were behind that, today we call them heroes. That's how perverted our education is. That's why we have no rights.
Right. Well, and you could say it's necessary and proper that everybody wears a mask during a pandemic, and it's necessary and proper that you must take a vaccine no matter what is in it during a pandemic. So, yeah, here we are.
You there, Dave?
Oh, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, that was weird. Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me? Okay. Okay.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry for that back and forth. Can you hear me? But
yeah,
that was weird. But Dave, we will have to admit that's not the first time that's happened with us.
Right. No, that's true. Yeah.
And look at the timing when it's happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Dave, let's take a look at something else, though. Something slipped by in the Bill of Rights that I don't think anyone thought about. Now, it happens to be the only amendment that the Supreme Court has never addressed in its individual status. They have addressed it in relationship to the 14th Amendment, but they have not addressed it specifically on its own merits. Now, they stay away from this amendment like, you know, it's unreal the way they stay away from this amendment. They will not hear a case based on the Ninth Amendment. And when they have once, when the Ninth Amendment was brought up, they dealt with it under the auspices of the not constitutionally ratified 14th Amendment.
Well, Mike, could you kind of go into the Ninth Amendment and why they refused to hear a case on it? That's very interesting.
Well, that was something I found very interesting some time back. And I started doing some great research into that. And then I looked to see about the arguments about the Ninth Amendment. And it's very simple. It says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Now, how simple is that?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Okay, so it is saying that the people have more rights than are listed in the Bill of Rights. That takes us back to the Declaration of Independence, our unalienable rights as endowed by our Creator. That was the reason that they've got the Ninth Amendment in there, and it has always just really, 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 I thought it was unreal that it's not addressed, and that but no, I don't find it unusual. I take that back. If I was on the Supreme Court and I was trying to control the people of the country, I'd stay the hell away from that amendment too.
Yeah, that's a huge limiter of absolute power, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so the thing that is funny is that allegedly that if we look at the National Endowment for the Humanities with that wonderful U.S. government seal, it says that what Madison put into the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. But if you go back and look at the actual discussion in the first Congress, that is not true. Now, can you imagine for a moment that the government might lie to you?
Yeah.
So what would, so what are your thoughts on that, Dave? What would you think about the Ninth Amendment? Why would that trouble?
Well, Mike, what year approximately was the Ninth Amendment passed?
Well, that was with the Bill of Rights in 1789.
Okay. Wow. So how I'm not quite clear on, like, how have they managed to completely ignore it just through case law, I guess, or how have they done that?
Well, there we have a huge problem, and that is that we do not allow, that we should not allow the Supreme Court to decide which cases it takes. And we have done that. We have allowed the Supreme Court to say, oh, no, well, we won't hear that case.
Right. And can they just arbitrarily, I guess they can just choose whatever they want to hear or not hear, right? I mean, there's no set of rules that dictates to them what cases they have to hear.
Exactly. And here is exactly, I'll quote from James Madison on this discussion on the Ninth Amendment. And let's see what he had to say. And this is directly, again, from the Library of Congress. It has been objected also against a Bill of Rights that by enumerating particular exceptions to the grant of power, it would disparage those rights which were not placed in that enumeration. And it might also be by implication that those rights which were not singled out were intended to be assigned into the hands of the general government and were consequently insecure. This is one of the most plausible arguments I have ever heard urged against the admission of a Bill of Rights into the system, but I conceive that it may be guarded against. I have attempted it, as gentlemen may see, by turning to the last clause of the fourth resolution. So he does say that he has supported the Ninth Amendment, so perhaps we have to give him that much credit and along those lines. But then again, in the arguments, let's look at what Richard Henry Lee, who wrote as the Federal Farmer, let's see what he had to say about the Ninth Amendment. He said, we must consider this Constitution when adopted as the supreme act of the people, and in construing it hereafter, we and our posterity must strictly adhere to the letter and spirit of it, and in no instance depart from them. In construing the federal constitution, it will be not only impracticable, but improper to refer to the state constitutions. They are entirely distinct instruments and inferior acts beside by the people now establishing certain fundamental rights. It is strongly implied that they are of opinion that they may not otherwise be secured as part of the federal system. So what happened here, and this was the argument made by the Federalists. The Federalists said, you do not, when they were saying you don't need a Bill of Rights. And they said this to Luther Martin. They said, you don't, we're not putting a Bill of Rights into this Constitution. Now, this was at the convention when Luther Martin and George Mason and Elbridge Gerry were arguing for a Bill of Rights. And they said, no, we're not putting them in there because the people have their rights in the state constitutions. They have their Bill of Rights in the state constitutions, so we don't need one in the federal constitution. And that's when Luther Martin said, no, guys, I'm sorry, but with the necessary and proper clause, with the general welfare clause, and with the supremacy clause, all of the rights of the people as listed in their state constitutions are made null and void. Because the federal government can rule through their judicial system that those rights are not effective. And that's exactly what the federal government has basically just neutered all state constitutions with their Bill of Rights.
Yeah, and of course the power of the federal government supersedes the power of the state government anyway. So that seems
with the Supremacy Clause.
Right. So that seems like a fallacious argument anyway.
Well, it was. And I was very interested in reading Luther Martin. And here's another reason why people haven't read about Luther Martin is Luther Martin in the dealing with the judiciary. He said that he believed, and he tried to put this into the Constitution. And of course, the Federalists wouldn't go for it. He said that the Supreme Court should only be brought into action or brought into effect when two states differed on the same subject. That then and only then, and not in every case anywhere, should the Supreme Court have any authority. It should be decided on the state level by the courts that were closest to the people and not decided by a court that was hundreds or thousands of miles away from the people. And that was his proposal, that the Supreme Court only be allowed to hear those cases in which state Supreme Courts disagreed. And then in any case that went to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court would argue the case in front of a jury. And the jury would decide the outcome of the case, and not nine people well politically connected serving for life with no election. And that was voted down. Why would that be voted down, Dave? Why would you not want that action for the Supreme Court? And did that not make sense?
Yeah, very, very interesting. Yes, it does.
Because if you're dealing with a regional issue or with a state issue, and let's just take, for example, let's say Utah. Let's say Utah, which is predominantly Mormon, is dealing with an issue that involves Mormon philosophy. Why would a court all the way in Washington, D.C. have a better feeling and a better understanding of the feelings of the people of Utah than the courts in Utah themselves?
Right.
And that was Luther Martin's point. And imagine, and wouldn't it be fantastic today if every case the Supreme Court heard was decided by a jury and not by the judges?
Yeah.
You think we'd have Roe v. Wade if a jury had been picked for that one?
No, there's no question about it.
Well, let's go back to our issue of the day, the Jacobson versus Massachusetts. Had there been a jury sitting there and the judges said all liberties, all rights of the people are subject to the police power of the state, do you think a jury would have gone along with that?
Especially not back then. People were so much more aware and well-educated back then. Not a chance in the world.
Oh, well, I've blathered on and on in here, Dave. Something you would like to especially discuss?
Well, you know, Mike, this is sort of jumping a little bit off from where you were, but it's a sort of a corollary concept. You know, we were talking about the necessary and proper clause and things associated with it. And, you know, it's got me thinking about this concept of national security, which is sort of a similar concept. It's certainly a corollary. And I was wondering, you know, when that became an issue. I know during the World War II era, it certainly was. But was that talked about like during the Civil War and before? Or when did that become a staple of government power, national security?
Well, that came about primarily after World War II. That became a real issue then because we were all, remember, well, no, you're not old enough. You're not remember jumping under your desk for a nuclear attack drill when you were in second or third grade.
My parents told me about it, yeah.
So they went into a fear program immediately after World War II. And the way that you dominate and control a people is, the government has two things, fear and force. And if you do not adhere to the fear factor, in other words, if you don't adhere to the COVID thing, then they're going to bring in the military and bring the force. So it's always government since World War II, especially in this country, has been on the fear and force angle. And I could take that back to Reconstruction. You could go back to the end of the not-so-Civil War, and we could say that it began its implementation back then. They didn't phrase it as national security. That became the phraseology, but the ideology was the same during Reconstruction. Because
right, and it's just I'm sorry. Go. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's just amazing that Reconstruction and the military martial law essentially lasted for 12 years after the Civil War. It's hard to believe.
Well, we're headed right back for it again. And that is what amazes me, is that the so-called Christian conservative right is calling for it in some instances. And I was on a program yesterday with Jim Ram, and I was on his program for an hour. And he was very much against it, to all his credit. He's a Trump supporter, very much against the calling of martial law and what have you. But he told me, he said, I tell you what, if Trump were to declare martial law, I can promise you most of the people in my church would cheer for it.
Yeah.
And there are people advocating that Trump shut down the media, because they have been against him for his 4 years, that if he declares martial law, he can shut down the media. Well, Abraham Lincoln shut down 300 newspapers.
And put people in jail, too.
Yeah, coming back for the next one in the flip side. Thanks, folks.
From now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain, I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain. As free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning, and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio.
All right, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, folks, to the last segment of Dare to Think Out Loud. And Dave and I have been prone to think out loud on many occasions, and nobody has to dare us to do so. Right, Dave?
Oh, absolutely. And it's more important than ever, too. You know, everyone needs to start speaking out, because I believe time is running short if people just keep complying with this agenda that's unfolding, Mike.
Well, I don't think, I'll be honest with you, and we talked about this some last night, and I know my friend Terry didn't like what I had to say, but not that he felt like I was wrong. He just didn't want to hear it. And that was the fact that I don't think there's any way to save this thing. We are too far in the hole. We've got too many people in power in this government who are socialists. We have very few moral people in this government on either side of the aisle, if I can use that phrase. And you cannot have a moral country with an immoral leadership. It just will not work. And it made me think, again, going back to original documents, there was this gentleman who was a delegate to the North Carolina Ratification Convention, and his name was Henry Abbott. And it was A-B-B-O-T, not double T. And have you ever heard of Henry Abbott with your history degree, Dave?
Well, no, I have not.
Okay, well, Henry Abbott was speaking directly to Article 6, Clause 3 of the Constitution, the one that did away with any oaths to any form of Christian faith, or any other faith for that matter, but specifically the Christian faith. And you might ask, well, why do you say the Christian faith? And I would say that because at the time of the Constitution in 1787, 12 of the 13 states, the only one that didn't have an oath to the Christian faith was Rhode Island. The other 12 states had an oath in some form or fashion, very specifically to the Christian faith. Well, Article 6, Clause 3 did away with that in the federal government, and it also included the state governments because the Senate, for the Senate at that time, before the non-ratified 17th Amendment, the Senate at that time was picked by the state legislature. So they didn't want anyone coming to the Congress with an oath to the Christian faith. Now, again, you're going to say, well, that's all faiths. Well, all faiths weren't that much represented back then. The states that did have an oath were to the Christian faith, and very specifically to the Christian faith. So what was eliminated with Article 6, Clause 3 was an oath to the Christian faith in 12 states. You can paint that picture any way you want to, but that's the bottom line. So Henry Abbott, when they were arguing Article 6, Clause 3, made one of the most prescient statements one will ever hear. He said, well, if we allow this to stand in our Constitution, Article 6, Clause 3, it will come a time in this country where our government will be infested with pagans, non-believers, and Muslims. Now, how did he know that in 1788?
That is amazing. How did he know that?
Well, back then, they didn't use the word Muslim. They used Mohammedans, which was Mohammed. They used that, and they called them because I don't think they had the Muslim phrase back then. But that was basically what he was saying. But if you do not specifically say we're going to have a government with no oath to the Christian faith, then you are going to allow anyone into your government. And in no way could this country ever claim to have been a Christian nation. They do it all the time, but it's false. Because they did away with the oath to Christianity and with the Constitution.
Right. And, you know, it's undeniable that the country was founded on those principles. You can't deny it. And also, you can't deny that Western civilization in general is the result of those principles of Christianity. I don't see how you can separate the two if you're honest about it.
Exactly. And I agree with that totally. So, there is so many things to look at, you know, that we don't even know about. You know, and again, we're not taught about it. That to me is one of the amazing parts. I was looking for, especially for some arguments over that article in the Constitution, Dave. So pardon me for a second. If you want to lead off on something else here for just a second, let me see if I can get those arguments up on my computer.
Well, sure. Well, I would just say a corollary to what we're talking about is if you don't have any kind of spiritual principles by which people are supposed to behave, that vacuum will be filled by the power of government. I think maybe that's where that man got his insights about pagans and Mohammedists, because it'll be filled by something, because people have to have some type of doctrine by which they live, or else human behavior just degenerates into debauchery.
Exactly. And here I found one, and I've got two that I can show you right now. But number one is the Vermont Constitution of 1777. And in that Constitution, which was in effect when the Constitution was being debated, Constitution of 1787, and in that it states under Section 9 of the Vermont Constitution, a quorum of the House of Representatives shall consist of 2/3 of the whole number of the members elected, and having met and chosen their speaker, shall each of them there before they proceed to business take and subscribe as well the oath of fidelity and allegiance herein after directed as the following oath or affirmative. Okay, here was the oath in Vermont. I, blank, do solemnly swear by the ever-living God, for I do solemnly affirm in the presence of Almighty God that as a member of this assembly, I will not propose or assent to any bill, vote, or resolution which shall appear to me injurious to the people, nor do or consent to any act or thing whatsoever that shall have a tendency to lessen or abridge their rights and privileges as declared in the Constitution of our state, but will in all things conduct myself as a faithful, honest representative and guardian of the people according to the best of my judgment and abilities. And each member, before he takes his seat, shall make and subscribe the following declaration. I do believe in one God, the Creator and the Governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good and punisher of the wicked. And I do acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration and own and profess the Protestant religion. Now, that was in the Vermont Constitution, which Article 6, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution made non-existent. I mean, they could keep it in their state constitution. They just couldn't send anybody to the federal government if they took that oath. And here, just as an example, I'll read you Delaware's. I'm not going to read all of them, but let me run this one by you. That'll be two. In Article 22 of the Delaware Constitution, it says, every person who shall be chosen a member of either house or appointed to any office or place of trust before taking his seat or entering upon the execution of his office shall take the following oath or affirmation if conscientiously scrupulous of taking an oath, to wit, I, blank, will bear true allegiance to the Delaware state, submit to its constitution and laws, and do no act willingly whereby the freedom thereof may be prejudiced. And I also make and subscribe the following declaration, to wit, I, blank, do profess faith in God the Father, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore, and I do acknowledge the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. Now, there are two oaths in state constitutions, and like I said, there's 10 more. I'm not going to bore you with all 10. They vary a little bit in wording, as you heard, between Delaware and Vermont, but they have the same principle. Is an oath to the Christian faith. And the Constitution, Article 6, Clause 3, made sure that no one taking that oath could come serve in the federal government. So figure that one out for yourself.
That's amazing. And it's just been pretty much written out of history. I think very few people are even aware of that or would admit it because it doesn't coincide with their political ideology. Maryland, one of the states that was aligned to Catholicism originally?
Had a lot of Catholicism there, but our founders, quote-unquote, were very much against They were very much against what they referred to as papist. They didn't use the word Catholic. They used the word papist. But they were very much against papists having any position in the government as well. And not only that, Dave, but guess what? They didn't want any people of the Jewish faith in their government.
Right.
Either.
Right. Well, that makes sense. It's very interesting. Very interesting. And that, here again, this has been written out of history. Very few people would acknowledge this, even if you told them about it.
Well, that's what I've been saying for years. You know, and I brought this up with someone the other day, and I was being a smartass. And they asked me, they said, well, what makes you think that? And I said, well, for number one, between Thomas Jefferson and George Washington alone, there were 1,242 letters. I've read every one of them. How many have you read?
Well, certainly not every one of them.
Well, I wasn't making that statement to you, but I was making it to someone else as a point of, you know, they asked me, how did I know something that they hadn't been taught? And that was my point.
Right.
And I was making this point to a friend last night. If you read the letters between Jefferson and Washington, and again, there's 1,232 of them. If you read the letters, especially in Washington's first administration, you do not have to be a brain surgeon to figure out that Washington was not running the country Alexander Hamilton was. Because if you follow the sequence of letters, you would see Jefferson as Secretary of State ask Washington as president, why is Hamilton able to do this? Why is Hamilton doing these things? Why is Hamilton issuing an executive order when he's not the executive? Why is Hamilton doing these things? And so you see the letter from Jefferson to Washington. Then you look 2 days later, and there is a letter from Washington to Hamilton asking him about why are you doing these things? So, and I can cite you chapter and verse. So why, if you were president of the United States, why would you have to write to your Secretary of Treasury and ask him why he's doing anything? And I also found it ironic, of course, you know, presidents take vacations. George Washington may have been doing so. But at that time, the letters from Jefferson to Washington went to Mount Vernon. And the government, the center of the government at that time was either in New York or Philadelphia. So Washington wasn't at the seat of government during the time those letters were written.
Huh. Wow. And what do you make of that?
Well, I make it very simple as the fact that, to be honest, if you read his own letters, Washington really did not want to get involved in government after the war was over. He was manipulated by Hamilton and several of his generals and Madison into coming to the Constitutional Convention of 1787. because they knew they would never get this Constitution passed without Washington's blessings. And so they asked him to come. He originally said he wouldn't because he had other commitments. He had written letters to Madison saying, look, all I want to do, I've had enough of this. I'm ready to leave it up to other people. I want to go back to the pleasures of my plantation. I want to go back and be involved as an agrarian. I want to go back and enjoy what I enjoy. He did not want to get into politics. And he did it reluctantly at the behest of General Knox and General Franklin and Madison and Hamilton.
Yeah. Cal in the chat room is saying that Hamilton was running the country as if he was president.
Oh, I agree with him totally. He's exactly right. Cal's exactly right.
Yeah.
Because, again, as president of the United States, why would I have to ask my Secretary of Treasury why he had issued an executive order?
Yeah, exactly.
And if we consider, and there's considerable evidence to this, there's considerable evidence that Hamilton was the puppet of the international bankers, even back then, who was running our country in the beginning.
Or the representative of the international bankers, let's say.
Well, unfortunately, with history as it was, that's hard to track. But we do know Hamilton left the Constitutional Convention on five occasions.
Wow.
And he went back to New York. One time he came back from New York to Philadelphia and didn't even stop in at the convention. He made a trip there. Those trips are documented. What he did is not documented. So we can't say who he talked to when he went to New York.
But sure, but it's pretty easy to figure out what he was up to, I think.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt, especially if you take that time frame and examine Hamilton's letters back to members who were still at the Constitutional Convention. When you look at his letters to Gouverneur Morris, Rufus King, and others, and look at what he was saying in those letters. And see, here's the point I think that's lost on most folks, is that after Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. left the Constitutional Convention in disgust because they felt like the people at the Constitutional Convention were exceeding their authority, which they were, and they left and went back to New York, that removed a quorum for New York. So Hamilton was the only person left, and he could vote. Well, they let him vote, but his vote did not count. So once the quorum for New York had been removed from the Constitution, why was Hamilton allowed to participate in any manner? Because whatever he did was not reflective and was not representative of the people of New York, because the people of New York had lost their voice when Lansing and Yates left.
Right. And what were Hamilton's letters saying? What's the gist of what was said in those letters?
Well, he was saying, you know, if anything happens while I'm gone that you think I need to know, please let me know. And, you know, which was kind of funny at that time because it took a letter like 5 days to get anywhere back then, especially between. And but, you know, if there's anything I need to know, if there's any basic changes in the plan, and he sent a letter to Rufus King, and he said, I plan to come back because I want to be there at the end. And then, of course, one can only speculate that at the end he was put onto the Arrangement and Style Committee with Gouverneur Morris, and Gouverneur Morris completely changed and left out some clauses and put in some clauses. Gouverneur Morris, that is a show that we need to do sometime, how Gouverneur Morris, and there is a petition before the Supreme Court now addressing that. I doubt they'll ever hear it, but that the what Gouverneur Morris put into the Constitution, and he totally rewrote the preamble of the Constitution. He's the one that put in "we the people." And it's my point that that phrase should have been "we some of the people." But he put "we the people" into that. He changed the entire preamble to the Constitution all on his own. without any input from other sources. He did that. And when you remember that Gouverneur Morris spoke more and introduced more stuff at the Constitution than any other delegate, it becomes quite questionable.
Well, and Mike, I find it just fascinating that you know, Hamilton left the convention five times, and we don't know what he was up to. That implies there is some level of secrecy as to what he was doing. I just find that absolutely fascinating.
Well, that is true, and they all took an oath to not mention anything they had done for 50 years. But yet, Hamilton was writing letters back to members while he was in New York. So was that a violation of his secrecy oath?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a question that could be asked.
Yeah, and what, you know, you said that he went from New York to Philadelphia without even stopping at the convention. Is that what you said?
He made one trip where he went from Philadelphia and he visited with someone in Philadelphia, and I could only presume that would have been Gouverneur Morris or Robert Morris. And he visited them and then went back to New York, which makes me think it was all a banker thing, because Gouverneur Morris and Robert Morris were heavily involved in the banking aspect of the whole deal.
And right, remember, and New York was the sort of the capital of banking even back then in the United States.
And also remember that in Article 6, Clause 1, they had interjected into the Constitution that only the debts that the United States owed were to be paid. No debts that were owed to the United States would be mandated to be paid after that. So the big question is, who owed money to the United States that was actually in the Constitutional Convention that got rid of their debt with that clause?
Who was that?
Robert Morris.
Oh, wow.
And then they slipped in the, ex post facto law, which would, because basically Robert Morris, as financier of the Revolutionary War, he embezzled $270,000 from the U.S. government to start his bank. So, and that is, the evidence is there in the Library of Congress. He took $270,000 out of a loan from France to the U.S. He took $270,000 in gold out of $400,000 in gold and started his own bank. So he owed the U.S. government at least that $270,000. So, but and he was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, and Article 6, Clause 1 made sure that he could never, that he wouldn't have to pay it back, and the ex post facto law in the Constitution made sure that he could never be charged for embezzlement after the Constitution was ratified.
Wow, you know, this is amazing, Mike. You know, the song remains the same, doesn't it? And let me ask you, where does Haim Salomon fit into this? Because he also financed the Revolutionary War as well, right?
Well, there were several of them, and this was a discussion I was having on my link this morning on Teach Me, that I was having, that we know, and they said we had to get away from the Articles of Confederation because we owed all this debt that we couldn't pay. But you can go through all of the records you want to, and we know that this debt that America owed was to individuals like Haim Salomon. We know that, but there are no documents, even in the National Archives or anywhere else, that says who these individuals were. It refers to the debt owed by this country is owed to individuals, but it does not list them. And I would say, if you have a legal document, why would you not list the people who are owed money?
Yeah, that is very strange.
The reason that you wouldn't list them is because you would not want people to know who was owed money.
Yeah. Yeah, that is odd. Why would you want to forgive debts when people owe you money? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, and Article 6 says Clause 1 says only the debts against the United States. It doesn't say anything about the debts owed to the United States. And there was actually an investigation of Robert Morris in Congress. And, of course, the Federalist in Congress helped him cover it up before the Constitutional Convention. But after the Constitutional Convention, he was free and clear. He had nothing to worry about. And there, the Anti-Federalist Sentinel said that Robert Morris realized about a $17 million profit off that deal.
In today's money or in the money of that time period?
Money of that time period.
Wow. That must be like, what, $170 million or more in today's money?
He would be a Bill Gates, I promise you.
Yeah. That is amazing.
Well, Dave, this has been fun, buddy. I always enjoy these times with you. I appreciate you coming on and us being able to do this discussion.
Yeah, and Mike, thanks for the history lesson. You know, someone that made a donation to Revolution Radio recently said that they feel like they need to take notes because there's so much history that's being put forth during your shows, and I totally agree.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate that. I'm glad that some people are getting some knowledge, and I'm always glad to quote sources for those who want them. Well, looks like we're done, folks. Maybe LB will be back next week. We shall find out. But thanks very much for tuning in to Dare to Think Out Loud. Have a great weekend, everyone. Thanks, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Revolution.